arraignment is set for next week, and an anticipated not guilty plea for the 17-year-old charged with homicide for fatally shooting three people and wounding a third in the August unrest in Kenosha following the police shooting of Jacob Blake. We're looking at the latest developments in the case here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The family of 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse has been raising money for his criminal defense. He was released on $2 million bail a little over a month ago. Have you been following the case? What do you think of the family's fundraising tactics? It's 800-642-1234. Bruce Velmetti covers courts and legal affairs for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Bruce, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks. Glad to be here.
So explain, before we get into the charges, explain where we are in this case with the court proceedings.
Well, as you just mentioned, Kate, the arraignment is coming up on the 5th, and that'll be, it's a pretty pro forma hearing generally. He'll appear in court virtually by Zoom and enter a formal not guilty plea. That's about where we're at. There's really not been much else happening in the case, and from there, it'll move into the longer drawn out, you know, discovery and scheduling, and I imagine that'll take quite a while.
Explain where we are with the charges. What is Rittenhouse currently charged with?
Well, actually, he's charged with an additional new count that they just added this week. It's minor. It's a ticket, actually. He was for violating curfew, essentially, is all it is. But he's facing the more serious counts are five felonies and a misdemeanor. And they are first-degree intentional homicide. That's the most serious count. That was for the first death. The first man he shot, that was Joseph Rosenbaum. First-degree reckless homicide is the another death. Obviously, that's Mr. Huber. First-degree reckless endangering safety. He faces two counts of that. These are for shots he fired, which prosecutors meant, you know, were aimed at somebody but didn't hit anyone. Attempted first-degree intentional homicide. That's Mr. Grosskreutz. The gentleman was shot in the elbow. And then kind of a more interesting and contentious is the misdemeanor count, which is possession of a gun, firearm, by someone under 18 years old. That would seem the simplest, but his lawyers insist online and in court have tried to have that thrown out, arguing that that's that he was entitled at 17 to carry the rifle.
And so this has been one of the contentions here by the defense team trying to remove two of the charges, but that was denied by the Kenosha County Court Commissioner. Is that right?
That's right. That's this issue of whether he's allowed to carry the rifle. I think it's been argued now before the commissioner, and I think they'll bring it up again with the court, but I think it's pretty clear that the courts aren't going to go for that. It's based on a real kind of interesting reading of the statute, and the statute's admittedly confusing and poorly written in the exception that they're citing, but it's kind of one of these where, in the larger sense, it doesn't make sense for the exception to apply, I think. I think that's how most of the judges are going to see it.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with reporter Bruce Velmetti, who covers courts and legal affairs for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been covering the Rittenhouse case. Have you been following this case? What would you like to know about it? 800-642-1234 to join in. So this is set against the backdrop of the Black Lives Matter demonstrations in Kenosha after Jacob Blake, a black man, was shot multiple times by a white officer. What have social justice efforts looked like surrounding this case and what the connection here is to Rittenhouse?
Well, clearly it was the demonstrations in the wake of the Blake shooting that brought all these people into Kenosha that evening, including Kyle Rittenhouse. You know, since then, he and his support, it's kind of hard to tell. I guess there haven't been a lot of demonstrations exactly focused about the Rittenhouse case. When I was in Waukegan, Illinois, where he was initially held as a juvenile after turning himself in, there were some demonstrators outside the courthouse chanting, "Send him back." That's when he was trying to avoid extradition and fighting extradition back to Wisconsin. Some of the protesters and demonstrators have filed different civil rights lawsuits that have named him and others involved in the counter protest, if you call it, or the protection, if they'd call it, that was happening that evening. So those cases are in the federal court system as civil rights cases. Those will take much longer to play out. And again, are sort of a long reach, in my opinion, but they raise the issues you're talking about, whether the government and whether the private responders in two different cases are responsible for these deaths in a way, or from damages other demonstrators say they suffered at the hands of either Kyle Rittenhouse, other armed people who came to the events that night, or the police.
We got a call from Steve in Madison, couldn't stay with us. And Steve wants to know, is the public allowed to know who is paying for Rittenhouse's defense team? And if so, who is paying for the defense team?
Well, we're not allowed to know in exact terms, but in general, it appears at least that Second Amendment, you know, gun rights advocates and others around the country appear to be paying for his defense. When he was first charged, there was nearly $2 million donated to his defense, and that money hasn't all really been too well accounted for, and that's a separate issue. But some of it and other major donations from celebrities went to posting his $2 million bail. His family and one of his lawyers are currently beating the bushes pretty hard to raise another $2 million they say will be necessary to actually defend the case. And that's they have a website, and it sort of tracks. They claim about 1,400 people have made donations in the neighborhood of about $75,000 so far.
And just recently, one of his attorneys, John Pierce, has stepped away from the case. There's been ethical and financial issues with Pierce. What is going on there?
That's actually one of the more interesting aspects of the case, in my opinion, so far. Yes, John Pierce was a sort of self-appointed big shot lawyer from Los Angeles. He started a law firm a few years ago. The law firm very quickly kind of broke up and had a lot of debt. He was also involved in some personal litigation and a divorce. And so he teamed up with the guy, Lynn Wood, who many of the listeners might know of, is currently being involved in one of the attacks on the election results in Georgia. He's an Atlanta lawyer, became famous for defending Richard Jewell back in the Olympic bombing case in Atlanta. And they are the ones who started the foundation that secured most of the original donations for the defense. So Pierce did step away from the foundation. Now he's formally stepped away from the defense. On the other hand, he is still defending Kyle Rittenhouse continually on social media. He's very active on Twitter. He and Kyle's mother go on a lot of interviews with conservative websites. Today, I just watched one from InfoWars. That's the Alex Jones far-right network. Other areas like Blaze TV, and they're on a lot promoting the website for donations and also their theory of the defense. So technically, it's Mark Richards, who's a legitimate, very excellent criminal defense lawyer from Racine, who's handling the actual defense in the Wisconsin courts.
We're talking with Bruce Valmetti, a legal affairs reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, bringing us up to speed on the case of 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse, who's due back in court for his arraignment next week. Have you followed this case? Have you donated to the family's criminal defense fund? Why did you decide to donate? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're discussing the latest in the criminal case of the 17-year-old Kenosha shooter. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Illinois teenager Kyle Rittenhouse is charged with fatally shooting two people during the August protest following the police shooting of Jacob Blake. He was released from jail last month after posting a $2 million cash bail, and his arraignment is set for next week. What questions do you have? Are you an attorney following this case? What do you think of the defense's fundraising? What are you watching for in court proceedings? It's 800-642-1234 to join in. Bruce Valmetti covers courts and legal affairs for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he's our guide. Let's take a call now. Jimmy is joining us from Valley Junction. Hi, Jimmy. Go ahead.
Morning. I was wondering if the district attorney considered something lower than first-degree murder, because and hopefully they'll be able to, the jury will be able to consider something less than that, because I worry about these all-or-nothing charges where it might be a reach to go to first-degree murder when a lower charge might be easier to prove. And I was wondering if the police or the authorities in charge have faced any blowback for allowing these folks to roam around with weapons in you know, such a volatile situation. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Jimmy, thank you for that. And Bruce, starting with the prosecution and what its approach is to this case.
The gentleman has a good question. I was frankly a little surprised that one of the counts included first degree intentional homicide. If you, and I'm sure everyone's seen the video by now, the same video that Kyle's defense team says shows he's clearly acting in self-defense and that he shouldn't have been charged at all is pretty unclear about the first count. That's the intentional homicide count, and that's involving Joseph Rosenbaum. That's the one you really can't see as well what happened. But I think they may have done that just because they can also get that. It may have had something to do with his arraignment. I mean, the extradition. While he was still in Illinois, he was not entitled to any kind of bail because of the first-degree intentional homicide count that may put him in potential life imprisonment. And that triggered a provision in the extradition laws that said he couldn't get any kind of bail while he was in Illinois. I think they really are ready on almost any kind of these first-degree intentional homicide cases. Most of the time, the jury does have the option of what they call a lesser-included offense, maybe reckless homicide, that kind of thing. So that's very likely going to come into play here, I believe, that the first-degree intentional homicide is unlikely to be convicted, the convicted count.
Rittenhouse had an AR-15 at the time of the shooting, and prosecutors have said an older friend bought him the rifle. What do we know? What do you know about the weapon?
The weapon's interesting. That's his friend Dominic Black, who's 19 and is or was, at least at the time, dating Kyle's sister. That's how they knew each other. They also had been up and purchased the weapon earlier in the year in the spring when Kyle joined Dominic's family up north in Ladysmith, Wisconsin. And Kyle has said, told the police that he had extra money. He'd gotten a couple of unemployment checks. And if you remember early in the pandemic, there was an extra $600, which I'm sure was well more than he was normally earning as a lifeguard. And he had decided to spend $1,200 or so on this rifle. He couldn't buy it, of course, at 17, but his friend was 18 and bought it for him. And they used it to shoot targets out in the rural areas up north. And his friend Dominic also kept the gun at his father's house in Kenosha. So the early disputes and rumors was that he'd gone across state lines with the rifle and all that weren't true. The rifle stayed in Wisconsin the whole time. But his friend is charged with getting him the rifle, both when he obtained it for him from the store, purchased it, and also when he gave it to him before they went downtown that evening. So he faces two counts of a felony. Each is punishable by like about 3 years in prison.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Bruce Valmetti, who is a legal affairs reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's bringing us up to speed on the Rittenhouse case and taking your questions, your insights about it, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Mary Kay now, joining us from Kenosha. Hi, Mary Kay. What would you like to say?
Good morning. About the straw purchase, I do believe that man should be charged, okay? It was a straw sale. Another thing is my city was burning. That was my city. The entire city was burning. We had to call in people from outside to protect us. This was a very young man that was protecting himself. I seen the video. So again, I would like them to look at that too in self-defense.
And Bruce Rittenhouse has told police he was attacked while guarding a business.
That's not quite, I mean, he was guarding a business. That was his initial effort, his intention there. He was with several other armed men at one of the three locations for, I think it's called CarSource. But when he was actually attacked, he was actually walking away towards one of the other locations. And if you watch the videos, and there are many different cuts of the video, independent people have made anywhere from 11 minute to an hour compilations of the various videos that were taken that evening. So when he was actually attacked, he was on his way walking towards the location at 53rd and Sheridan Road, 63rd and Sheridan, when Mr. Rosenbaum began chasing him. So he was kind of out on the street walking, wasn't clearly protecting the business at the time. And then, of course, after the initial shooting, he was kind of escaping the growing crowd that was yelling, hey, that guy shot someone, and they were beginning to gather and chase after him at that point, yes.
These cell phone videos, will they be used as credible evidence for either the prosecution or defense teams or both?
Oh, clearly both. I mean, I was going way back to the days of the Rodney King beating in Los Angeles, I think back in the early 90s. Video is that very powerful piece of evidence, right? People see it and think it clearly shows one thing or clearly shows another. But over and over and over, when you get a piece of video to court and break it down frame by frame and bring in experts to discuss actions people are taking in those frames, video is never as clear as it looks in the first light, in my opinion. So yes, both sides will be making extensive use of the video. Obviously, there were also eyewitnesses to these events. I don't believe they've been able to find some of them, including one of the gentlemen who is seen kicking at Kyle early on before he fires at the people on the street in Sheridan, on Sheridan Road. One of the last hearings in court, I think it was said that they still haven't identified that person. He's a potential victim who was shot at, but they don't even know who that is. And that could be the case with a lot of these other people out in the field who saw things. On the other hand, there have been investigators for both the prosecutor's office and the defense trying to track down and interview these people ever since. So we may find out a lot of new information from their perspectives when the trial begins, if it ever begins.
When you look at the defense team's efforts to raise the bail, to raise additional millions of dollars for the defense, selling merchandise to help pay for the defense, how has the public responded to these requests?
Well, it's hard to tell. Mr. Pierce, that's the Los Angeles lawyer sort of leading what he calls the civil side of the defense. You know, he clearly makes it sound like there are thousands and thousands of people out there who support Kyle. And there probably are in the sense that among gun rights advocates, you know, the Second Amendment and self-defense has sort of been the core reason they've all been pushing over the years and finally successful. I mean, most states allowed concealed carry and always are opposing any kinds of restrictions on gun sales and use. So a lot of those people, without knowing much else about the case, I think are willing to back Kyle and at least be sure that he has a fair defense. Whether it goes beyond that, I'm not sure. Their lawyer is trying to spin some of this into future civil cases of defamation, which is sort of his specialty before he got involved in this. So they're looking for people to sue. They repeatedly claim they're going to sue President Biden, President-elect Biden's campaign over a piece that ran back in October after one of the debates in which reference was made to white supremacy and it showed Kyle's picture at the time. And so they're threatening to sue anybody who mentions Kyle in the same breath with white supremacists, that kind of thing. So they're looking for money down the line in terms of damages in addition to funds to fund the defense.
Bruce, as we wrap up here very quickly, no trial date set yet in the middle of a pandemic. What is the timeline for this?
That's a really good question. I would expect that no trial date will be set till very late in 2021, if not 2022. This is the kind of case that will have endless kinds of pretrial litigation. There should be lots of fights over the discovery materials. And again, as you mentioned, the pandemic makes all this a little more tricky because they're doing lots of it remotely. I know some counties are having, you know, trials in person and hearings, and they might move to that sooner than we think, and that'd be great. But even in normal times, this would be a very long, drawn-out case, in my opinion.
Bruce, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Bruce Valmetti, legal affairs reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We have a link to his work at WPR.org/mornings. Coming up, we learn what goes into making outdoor dining reality. That's after this news update on the Ideas Network. We're discussing outdoor plastic dining bubbles and other efforts to keep people eating out as safely as possible and doing it outdoors in our Wisconsin winter. Thanks for joining us here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Restaurants across the country and in Wisconsin, they've struggled for months to stay afloat. Some are making a run at outdoor seating with space heaters, outdoor plastic coverings. What is your experience dining outdoors in frigid temps? When was the last time you ate at a restaurant? Are you waiting until the pandemic is over? It's 800-642-1234. Tom Anderson is owner and operator of Buck and Honey's restaurant with locations in Sun Prairie, Monona, and Wanakee. Tom, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Good morning. We also have Eric Wagner with us, CEO of Lowlands Group, which owns 8 restaurants in and around Milwaukee and Madison. Eric, welcome to you.
Thanks, Kate. Also, happy to be around.
Well, Eric, let's start with you. We're in single digits down south this morning, well below zero in the northern part of our state. How do you do outdoor dining?
You get really, really crafty. We invented these ductworked heating systems outside of most of our domes and in our tents. We've had to get really innovative on trying to get electricity to them to heat them, but they're mostly all heated, and actually they're pretty comfortable until it gets, you know, into the frigid temps or it's really, really windy.
Okay, domes, tents, give us a mind's eye picture here of what you're talking about.
So our domes are 12-foot wide geodesic domes, and they're for private parties, mostly 6 people, sometimes 8. And then the greenhouses are 8-foot square greenhouses, and those sit up to a maximum of 6 people. And company-wide this year, we've rolled out about almost 30 of the greenhouses that we mostly call canal houses, and we've got about 14 domes across the company.
Wow. So this is quite a bit of outdoor infrastructure. Can I ask, how much have you spent on all of this?
I haven't looked at the full number because I don't know that I really want to. It has been a massive investment, but sitting on our hands just wasn't, it's not in our DNA, and it wasn't how we wanted to deal with it. So we thought we would just get as creative as possible. There's no doubt it's not a no-brainer, but so far the reception has been really great, and I think it's pulling a lot of people out that were maybe a little bit nervous to eat indoors, mm-hmm. and giving them an opportunity to do something, you know, really interesting with family and friends outside of the house.
All right, Tom, Buck and Honeys, how are you doing it outdoors?
You know, we're doing the best we can with the outdoor seating. Eric's group is leading the way on outdoor dining with the domes and the greenhouses. Eric, I was just at Hollander Cafe last week. We're out shopping at Hilldale and enjoyed a great meal there. So thanks for having us. Your staff was wonderful. And they're doing, kind of above and beyond in Milwaukee. I've been down there to visit their locations. We've jumped in the dome ideas and really enjoy it. We've decorated it. They look like Hallmark movies. really tried to go above and beyond for our guests to give them an experience in the dome creations. we don't have quite as many as the Lowland Group has expanded to. It's a difficult situation because of the expense that it takes. We actually built three of them that within 3 days got tore apart with a storm that came through with 60 mile an hour winds.
Wow.
And so it's a fine line of figuring out how to make them work. You need to certainly invest into the outdoor domes to make sure that they're sustainable to weather in Wisconsin, which can change daily, as we all know. Well, but we have some fire pits that are really, really expansive. We have a 30-foot firewall at our location in Monona that people love. And they'll sit out we'll make sure the snow's cleared off, and they'll sit by that daily with tables next to that and fire pits and stuff that we use. But we also have a couple of the domes that people just love. So what were you going to ask, Lee?
I was going to say, Tom, it's not only the infrastructure, but you also have to have that right real estate. You have to have that patio option in order to build out this outdoor seating.
Yeah. And one thing that we've been really fortunate, all of our locations they're pretty large locations with event spaces. Obviously that's been a huge area that's hurt us is our events and catering. We have multiple kitchens at each location. One kitchen handles the restaurant and the other kitchen handles our event spaces because we do so many parties. Obviously we haven't held an event at either location or any of the locations since March. So we're able to expand our guests and spread them out with social distancing and use those event spaces as overflow dining. And we've done some things to keep our guests really safe, such as the UV light for cleaning. And then we have an antimicrobial spray that we've put on our surfaces and done some filtration things with our HVAC systems to really help. Hopefully guests feel safe when they come to Buck and Honey's and we spread them out. That's kind of one of the goals that feels very spacious and very clean. And we do those types of things as well for indoor dining. But the outdoor, again, is the topic here. And we're trying to let them sit outside if they want, if we create those spaces for them.
We're talking with Tom Anderson there, who is owner and operator of Buck and Honey's restaurant. Eric Wagner is here, CEO of Lowlands Group, which owns 8 restaurants around the Milwaukee-Madison area. They're explaining their approach to outdoor dining and taking your questions about it as well at 800-642-1234. Eric, on the subject of indoors, how do you keep your patrons comfortable while dining inside and feeling safe? You have these outdoor options, but you will eventually also have patrons indoors.
Yeah, kind of along the lines of what Tom was saying, we've done all kinds of things. We've replaced our HVAC filters with MERV 13 filters, which are actually used in surgical arenas in many hospitals. We've separated all of our tables at least 6 feet apart. Our servers really from day one have been wearing masks, consistently. We really jumped on that early. And we've built, partitions throughout the restaurants to additionally keep people separated. And, with our HVAC systems, and I'm sure Tom's buildings are the same, they sound like, really nice big buildings. We're moving a lot of air in these buildings, and I think that helps a lot too. And just keeping people really separated. And I think the biggest thing also is making sure that they really understand that we take it seriously, our teams take it seriously, and I think that provides a lot of comfort.
Have you been able to get access to enough PPE, personal protective equipment? You mentioned masks.
We have. It was tight early on, but most of our staff has gotten creative on their own and have found them on their own. We also will hand them out to customers, so we have been able to get them in boxes. If for some reason somebody's forgotten one, we're happy to supply one when they walk in.
So at Buck and Honey's, what is the policy on mask wearing, Tom?
Oh, yeah, that, like Eric, since the very beginning, I think we were one of the first restaurants to actually shut down in March when we knew that the order was coming and we could see what was happening across the country. We closed down a couple of days prior to the order, and mask wearing was the number one thing that we required right away. We waited about a month to reopen for anything, for carry out, dining, whatever. So we just kind of hit pause and just kind of waited for the information to come to us and be prepared. We didn't open for indoor dining for quite a bit, but we did do some carry out after about a month and a half of the shutdown back in March. And you know, when it comes to the mask, that's number one. It's been a requirement, and we've taken an approach with our staff. Restaurants are, you know, they care about their staff so much, and that's, you know, and Eric's group, like all restaurants, they care, your staff is everything. They're family, and you know, you live together, you know, more than you do with some of your own personal family. So we took the approach of protect yourself. If everybody protects themselves, like to a T, then you will protect your coworkers and you'll protect the guests. So at any time you touch anything, make sure you're sanitizing and washing your hands. And we have sanitation stations set up throughout the restaurant. Anytime you deliver food, we wear gloves like nonstop. And to talk about PPE, gloves were, you know, a scarcity and very expensive. These PPP items for restaurateurs are so expensive. On top of, you know, gloves and masks and even to-go boxes, you name that. I mean, the expense that we carry just to do takeout and not change our pricing, these are different expenses that restaurants have taken on that we're just not used to either.
You're absorbing so much more.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, you got it. So, but protect yourself and it'll protect everybody else. And we just preach that. And that is so true with COVID, right? I mean, throughout in anything, if you're not feeling well, you know, so we went through processes of screening before anybody even punches in. They've got to go through a screening process when they come into work. They can't even touch the POS until they answer all these questions, get their temperature taken, yada, yada. And then they can punch in. So, we really started like focused on the staff person. And if we do that right away and everybody does that, then it'll protect everybody else. And that's really worked well. We haven't, knock on wood, we have not seen any spread in our restaurants at all internally. Obviously, people outside of, you know, you could go to a family function and it can happen, and that has happened. But as soon as it does, you deal with that in certain protocols.
Eric, would you like to add anything there about how you approach staffing in these times?
It has been an absolute roller coaster ride. I think really since the beginning, the shutdown happened and we started to reopen and there was so much confusion and fear. And it really took, you know, consistently talking with our teams. And I mean, I would be remiss without saying what an amazing experience it has been seeing, restaurant employees everywhere. But, you know, obviously we're most familiar with ours, going through what they have gone through, the pressure that they've been under, the mask wearing, the additional protocols, at times people not wanting to wear masks and all of these issues that were just so new. It's been remarkable seeing our people, and I'm sure Tom would say the same thing, rise to the occasion. But it has been really, really difficult. And it's just been a really trying time, obviously, for everybody. But we've also seen some really great people rise to the occasion.
We have restaurateurs Eric Wagner, Tom Anderson here explaining their efforts to seat patrons outdoors amid the pandemic and other efforts to keep patrons safe. You can join in. Should restaurants forge ahead and seat outdoors? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with restaurateurs Eric Wagner and Tom Anderson about how their locations are adapting to outdoor eating in the pandemic, how they're working with their staff. Outdoor dining is safer than indoor, but it's still risky, according to the CDC. And some cities, like Los Angeles, have started to ban outdoor dining as COVID cases continue to rise. Should Wisconsin restaurants seat customers outdoors in the winter? Has your restaurant remodeled its patio to seat people this winter? Is it financially viable? Will customers go for it? Join in 800-642-1234. And Eric Wagner and Tom Anderson, stay with us for 10 more minutes. Let's take a call now. Anthony is with us from Eau Claire. Hi, Anthony.
Hello, how's it going?
Good. What is your question?
I just wanted to ask Eric and Tom, they're talking about how they're purchasing a bunch of PPE equipment. And I was just wondering if they think about how that's taking away from the healthcare system. And if so, are they trying to help out at all with the healthcare system and hospitals around where their businesses are.
Eric, how about you first? Your reflections on PPE and where it goes.
Yeah, I don't know about the supply side and whether or not the few masks that we're buying to hand out for free to customers that don't have them is impacting healthcare. But I will say that the healthcare workers is something we take incredibly seriously. We have a great contingent of nurses that are in after the third shift in the morning for breakfast. And so actually last week for the week of Christmas, we donated 1,000, we call them snackoutery boxes, and they're effectively charcuterie boxes with snacks. Normally they retail for about $35 each. So we made a $35,000 donation to all the frontline workers last week, and they came and we delivered a bunch to Freighter, and we had a whole bunch of them picked up in our restaurant. So it's an issue that we take seriously. We respect what they have done for as long as they have done it. But I don't have visibility into the impact of the supply side.
Tom, anything to add there on the supply side and where PPE goes?
No, it's funny that this question came up. I asked one of our providers probably a month ago about that, the same question that the caller had. And I said, "Hey, as us, because we're struggling to get this stuff, you know." And this probably a couple months ago it was really hard to procure gloves, for example. I said, "Hey, we're struggling to get this. Does this take away from the healthcare workers?" And so he actually went to his, you know, above him and found out that this is secured for the hospitality industry or for the restaurant industry. Everything comes first to the hospitals and stuff. So he answered my question to make me feel good about the question that the caller had. So I believe, again, this is not, you know, data that I can document, but I believe that, you know, all of it goes to where it's needed the most in the front lines first. And that's why it's so difficult for hospitality and stuff to get it. And again, it has freed up, like Eric said. It's not as difficult today as it was maybe a couple months ago.
Well, I want to go back outside here for a moment, if you will, Eric. You know, wind, snow, extreme temperatures. How do the domes and the tents do with wear and tear? How do they hold up to our winter?
The wind is definitely a challenge. We have, for the greenhouses, we've actually run nylon straps over the top of them and secured them down to make sure that they don't go anywhere or have any major issues. The snow, if we get it off the tops, it actually works pretty well. And I will tell you that the most cozy time to be in these things is during a snowstorm. The heater works. You get six people in. It's really comfortable. We just have to be really, really aware of these big events like Tom was talking about. Those are the most dangerous parts.
Tom, what about for you in the, you know, you've had issues with wind. How do you deal with the wear and tear of this stuff?
Yeah, I, if there's any other restaurateurs out there that are listening to this and are thinking of doing some sort of outdoor dome or tent or anything, my advice is don't go for, you know, spend the money on the extra. And Eric will probably agree with this. We put up, like I said, two of them that we tried a different concept. Like, oh, these are, you know, these domes are a couple $1,000 a piece. The round ones, $1,500 to $2,000, and then you decorate it and everything. You're in for it's an investment. So we found some that were about half the price. Let's say $1,000 to put this tent in it. It had decent reviews, but yeah, within 3 days they were ruined. So if you're thinking about doing it, spend the extra money. And they're also very difficult to get because it is in such high demand that, you know, you're almost buying them now for next season.
Any advice you have there, Tom, on fire pits and maintaining those with your patrons?
Yeah, again, it's Wisconsin. So we have a 30-foot fire pit feature outdoors in our Monona location. And United Brick and Fireplace in Madison did that. We had it custom made, and they maintain it. And it's something that people really love. And it's a beautiful feature for the indoor diners to see outside. But when you're sitting next to it, it actually does give off heat. And, you know, it's Wisconsin, though. You know, if you're sitting outside and it's 10 degrees, a fire pit's not going to keep you warm.
Yeah.
So the dome is really the option for outdoor dining.
We're talking with Tom Anderson, owner and operator of Buck and Honey's restaurant. Eric Wagner is here, CEO of Lowlands Group, which owns 8 restaurants in and around the Milwaukee and Madison area, talking about outdoor dining and taking your questions and what you've experienced at 800-642-1234. Val is joining us now from Milwaukee. Hi, Val. What are your thoughts on eating outdoors?
Hey, good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. Unfortunately, while the efforts are much needed on behalf of all of the people who work in that industry, I hate to say it, but it's a waste of time. An encapsulated area, a seating area is a seating area. Aerosolized exhalations from people breathing, talking, laughing, it's going to be the same whether it's indoors or outdoors. So I'm sorry, but in my opinion, as far as the transmission and whatnot, it's not going to make a difference. It's not. A seating area is a seating area.
Eric, how do you respond there? A seating area is a seating area, regardless whether it's indoors or outdoors with transmission.
You know, the more that we learn from studies and the more that we see in the CDC, the more that we learn that it isn't passing outdoors as much and that it is safer outdoors. And then, you know, I think it is also different in particular. I don't know if the caller was talking about outdoors in general or particularly in the greenhouses and the domes, but it is different because each one of these is it's a private event for the people that you're close with. We stagger all of the reservations so that we have a half hour in between them so that we can come in and sanitize and clean. We've purchased these ionizer foggers. So we clean the air after each one and air them out. And these things are, you know, they're sieves, so they let air in and out of these things. So we actually think this is a really safe way for people to come out and enjoy themselves with people that are in their bubble.
We heard from Karen in Madison. Calden couldn't stay with us. Karen wants to know, Tom, how do you keep the food warm enough for people when you're moving it outdoors?
That's a good question and always a, you know, kind of a conundrum a little bit. We do have trays that have covers on them when we take them out, when we do take it outdoors. We have a little light, for example, and Eric probably has a system too with his. So for the domes and for our staff, you know, to check on the table and everything, we put a little light outside where if it's green, that means they're good. And if it's red, then that means they need service. So our staff isn't running back and forth outdoors when it's, you know, when it's freezing cold outside or when, you know, and obviously with food, we just cover the tray and get it there as fast as possible.
Eric, any tips there on keeping the food warm?
Yeah, I mean, it's all part of the gymnastics that restaurants have had to go through in every way. I mean, we kind of invented, you know, whole new family boxes that come in a box so that we can get it to the domes faster. And then we also use our to-go cardboard a lot in the domes to keep them covered. But and like Tom said, we use covers at times too. It is there's no doubt it's a challenge.
Well, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
It was thank a you.
Tom,
yeah, Eric, good to talk to you.
Same here, Tom.
Tom Anderson, owner and operator of Buck and Honey's restaurant with locations in Sun Prairie, Monona, and Wanakee. Eric Wagner, their CEO of Lowlands Group, owns 8 restaurants in and around Milwaukee and Madison. Just ahead, we have an author of History and Politics joins us to discuss the legacy of the Confederate soldiers buried in Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.